episode 76 of All About Fitness. On this episode, I speak with Dr. Tim Noakes, who's Emeritus Professor of Exercise Science and Sports Medicine at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. In addition, he was a co-founder and executive co-director of the Sports Science Institute of South Africa. Among the various topics he has studied and written about include ultra-endurance training with a specific emphasis on fatigue, nutrition with a specific emphasis on low-carb, high-fat diets, and hydration, and asking the question whether or not we are overhydrating ourselves. So in our conversation today, we cover all these topics. Plus, we talk about some simple changes that you can make to your diet and training program that might help you see the results you've been looking for. So after a brief word from the sponsor of All About Fitness, Dr. Tim Noakes. Vicor Fitness is the maker of the new TerraCore, which is a step, bench, balance trainer, and multifaceted exercise tool combined into one single platform. Go to VICOREfitness.com to see the newest piece of equipment that'll be taking the fitness industry by storm in 2017. Use the code AAF to save 20% on purchasing a TerraCore of your own. TerraCore by Vicor Fitness. Vicor Fitness, better results from better products. Hi, I'm Pete McCall with All About Fitness. I'm here today with Dr. Timothy Noakes from South Africa. Do you prefer Dr. Noakes, or can I call you Tim, or do you have a preference, sir?
Call me Tim, please, Pete. That'll be perfect.
Absolutely. Tim, can you give us give our listeners kind of a little background about you, about what it is that you do and what you've done in the exercise and in medical space?
Sure. I'm actually retired now. I'm 68 years old, but I've had a really exciting career. I first studied medicine at the University of Cape Town, graduated in 1974, very quickly realized that I was more interested in health than in disease, and also more interested in science. So I went directly from my medical training into a PhD program, completed that in 1981, and was asked to start teaching sports science at the University of Cape Town. So from 2015, I was involved in teaching of sports science at the University of Cape Town. And during that time, we developed a couple of novel ideas, particularly that the brain regulates exercise performance rather than the legs. I also was involved in teaching people that you can overdrink during exercise and get into trouble. And then, of course, I was a great promoter of high carbohydrate diets for athletes because we were absolutely convinced that if you wanted to perform your best in any sport, you had to eat lots of carbohydrate. But then, fortunately for me, in 2010, I realized I was completely wrong on that one. And so I changed my own diet to one of a low carbohydrate, high fat diet, and then began to promote the idea. And that led to great problems for me with my profession because they excommunicated me. And that involved a three-year legal trial for disgraceful conduct for prescribing or suggesting that mothers should wean their children onto higher-fat diets, which is traditionally, of course, what has always happened and actually is the South African dietary guidelines. But because I'd angered the South African dietitians so much because they were losing patients or clients who were now going to fix their own health because they read the other book I wrote, Real Meal Revolution, and they were eating real foods and benefiting. So I ran foul of the dietitians, and this led to this trial, which fortunately ended in April, and I won 10-0, the rulings. And I've just finished the book about that, and the book comes out this week, and it's called Law of Nutrition. And that describes what's happened to me over the last 6 years and the reasons why I continue to promote a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet. And so that's the subtitle of my career.
Well, and I think that's extremely interesting because as I was doing a little bit of research, Tim, on your background, you know, one of the things that caught my eye was in an article where during medical school, you were told that I'm looking for my line here, that during medical training, weren't you told that exercise was dangerous?
And why is that such a fallacy? I mean, what was your reaction to that when you heard that?
You know, that's really interesting because that was my department here. And I remember giving a lecture once, and the professor got up afterwards, the cardiologist, and said, "Dr. Noakes, you're dangerous. You're taking all these people with heart disease and you're making them run up the mountain and you're going to kill all of them." Well, that didn't quite happen, but I mean, that was the thinking at the day. So you're quite right. You know, 20 years later, or sorry, 40 years later, we wouldn't think that was even conceivable that people had said that. And I think in 40 years' time, we're going to say the same about this nutrition advice.
Well, that's what I was going to go into, is because if we were wrong, if you were in medical school in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and medical school was saying exercise is dangerous, and you have people now, you know, pushing one type of diet over another, aren't we going to learn more as we evolve about how the body adapts to the various inputs?
Yes, indeed. I think what frustrates me is, you know, why we have universities is because we don't know everything and we should be trying to push boundaries. And what I discovered in my own experience over the last 5 years is that nutrition is the single most important determinant of our health. And we can explain most of the chronic ill health that we have, be it heart disease, diabetes, cancer, dementia, or even the autoimmune diseases, on the basis of what we're eating. These diseases didn't exist in traditional populations eating traditional foods. And no one seems to quite put the two facts together, that it was the introduction of grains, cereals and grains 18,000 years ago or 12,000 years ago that caused the first problem. And the second problem was when we upped our carbohydrate intake after the 1970s. And before that, we were extremely healthy, but now we're in all sorts of trouble, and no one seems to be prepared to say, actually, it's the food we're eating that's the problem. Instead, my profession is so paternalistic that we say, how can the doctors be wrong? It must be the patient that is wrong. And so we blame the patient for the ill health instead of saying, well, let's try and find out what the real causes are.
Well, do you think that it has anything to do with the influence, the monetary influence of big industry of like what? Who is it? I don't know if it was Eric Schlosser, but it was another author who calls it the industrial food complex. Do you think they have a big influence on kind of what we consider proper nutrition?
Oh, absolutely. And the processed food is the cause of the problem, and because they've designed addictive foods, and so humans are addicted to eating these foods which have got very little nutritional value, and we're eating because we're addicted to the foods rather than that they are helping our bodies. And you know, in the past million years or so, 2 million years, we ate foods that we'd worked out are healthy for us and allow us to live long, healthy lives. And now we eat foods that are highly addictive because that's the toxic food environment in which we live. So yes, it's big food is the cause of the problem.
And now, what I think is very interesting with your work, Tim, is that you're in South Africa, so you are very close to a lot of indigenous populations that are still probably relatively close to the diet that they've been following for a few centuries. How have you seen, as more kind of quote-unquote modern diets have been introduced, how has that really changed some of the cultures and some of the indigenous peoples in the continent?
Yeah, you're quite correct. There are very few hunter-gatherers left in Africa, but those populations that are remain healthy and or as healthy or healthier than ourselves. The Maasai is a classic example in Kenya and Tanzania that they are extremely healthy and they live on a completely carnivorous diet, and the Samburai are exactly the same. In my own country, what happened was that the Nguni tribes, which led to all the black South Africans, came to Southern Africa 1,000 years ago, and they were cattle pastoralists, much like the Maasai. And over the last 150, 200 years, the cattle were decimated by a whole bunch of things, including a rinderpest, which is a virus that killed the cattle. And so what happened was traditionally people eating meat and dairy produce were then forced onto this diet that we currently eat, the industrial diet. And as a consequence, South Africans are amongst the fattest and most diabetic in the world. And I live in Cape Town, which is one of the centers for the diabetes epidemic. And when I graduated in medicine in 1974, diabetes was not the disease it is today. It is now absolutely epidemic in this part of the country. And what's changed? It's increased sugar intake and increased processed food intake. That's really what's happened. And looking around at people now, it's frightening to see how unhealthy the vast majority of people are in this country.
And so did that lead to your book, The High Fat Revolution, about where you promote a high fat diet? And what advantages does a diet that's rich in healthy fats? What advantages does it have for the body?
Well, the benefit is for people who are like me are insulin resistant. And so if you're insulin resistant, when you take in carbohydrate, your body can't assimilate or metabolize it normally. And you have to over-secrete the hormone insulin to drive the carbohydrate out of the bloodstream and then ultimately to convert it into fat. And so if you're insulin resistant, you over-secrete insulin all the time. And as a consequence, insulin has certain other effects because there are some tissues on which insulin overacts. And, for example, that then leads to arterial disease and dementia and probably cancer. So those are all linked to high-carbohydrate diets in people who are insulin-resistant. And so as soon as you take a person who's insulin-resistant and you get their blood insulin concentrations down to the normal range, they immediately benefit because they can start burning the fat instead of storing carbohydrate as fat. And because the insulin levels are low, all the inflammation and the damage that's been occurring in the body can start to heal. So the key piece of advice I give is that if you are insulin resistant, eating carbohydrates is highly toxic for you. And the less carbohydrates you eat, the healthier you will be and the longer you will live.
And I think that's important information. Is that also referred to as a ketogenic diet?
Yeah, indeed. The high fat. Once you cut carbohydrates and you bring your insulin down, then you can go into ketogenic state or ketotic state. And there are varying degrees of ketosis, and some people are more ketotic than others when eating less carbohydrate. But for myself, I have to go down to about 25 grams of carbohydrate to be significantly ketotic, and then I've got to go and run as well and exercise vigorously. So I'm quite resistant to ketosis, even though I eat very little carbohydrate. So again, we all differ. But I think the key is just to get the insulin down, and that really starts to make you healthy.
And that's one thing, that's one constant theme of my podcast, is that not everybody's going to respond to any research or any understanding the same way. And that it does involve some trial and error, correct, for people to kind of identify what works for them?
Oh, absolutely. People say, this diet is a one-size-fits-all. But the reality is the current dietary advice we have, that you're meant to eat low-fat, lots of cereals and grains, heart-healthy, prudent, balanced diet in moderation, that is a one-size-fits-all. But unfortunately, it doesn't fit very many people. The beauty of the Banting or the low-carb ketogenic diet is that it fits so many more people because it's certainly in the United States, at least 60% of the people are insulin-resistant. And increasingly more people are becoming more insulin resistant as they age. So this is a diet that's going to help at least 60% of the people in North America. And in my country, I'd say it's even higher, maybe 70, 80% of the people.
And I think that's what you don't know, and what I didn't tell you, Tim, is I'm actually right now I'm in Anaheim, California with my family at Disneyland. And I would tell you, if you want to see an unhealthy population, oh my goodness. And you can walk around and it's amazing the toxicity that people are putting into their body. Does exercise have any, is diet really a key driver of disease in the body? And is there anything that exercise can do to overcome that?
That's a great question because, we use the statement that you can't outrun a bad diet. And what that means is if you are insulin resistant and you're eating a high carbohydrate diet, you have to get the insulin down, and exercise isn't going to do it for you. So, I've been profoundly insulin resistant. I ran 70 marathons or ultra marathons, and I still developed type 2 diabetes. And I now look back and realize that the running helped a bit because I burnt off some of that carbohydrate, but I was never healthy. Whereas if I'd switched to a high-fat diet 35 years ago instead of switching to the high-carbohydrate diet, I would have been profoundly much more healthy, and I would also have been able to run much better. And my running would have continued at a higher level for much longer. But I didn't understand it at the time, and so I was feeding the devil, which was my insulin resistance, with this high-carbohydrate diet.
And I want to segue into that, because you've done a lot of work on – you just mentioned that you do ultra endurance. And one of the reasons I was interested in speaking with you is you're recently featured in an article in Men's Health talking about kind of the ultra, the extremes at which the human body can push itself. And have you really – I mean, what is the extremes? I mean, what – because we constantly see people challenging themselves to go harder. And as an ultra marathoner yourself, what do you think the upper limits are to human performance?
Yeah, I think that the longer the event, the more the brain is involved. And whereas at high-intensity exercise of short duration, it's not really your choice. The biology directs you. So we developed the central governor model of exercise, which predicts that the brain regulates your exercise performance to make sure you finish without dying. That's the key. And within that context, we do know that there are biological limits to what we can do. For example, you know, you can't sprint 100 meters in 3 seconds like a lion can, because we don't have the biology for it. The muscles are not strong enough. But probably what limits current speed in humans is the hamstring would rupture. If you run too fast, the hamstring has to slow down your foot before it hits the ground, and that takes a lot of power in the hamstring. And it's obviously clear that if you had unlimited power in the hamstrings, you would run faster, but you'd probably rupture either the muscle, or you'd rupture the femur, the bone in the thigh. So those are physical limits. But once you start to exercise over a day or two, then it's clear that the brain becomes far more important regulator. And the discipline of keeping yourself going and having a goal and thinking it's valuable and keep going, that becomes a factor. So our more recent research with the central governor model shows that in exercise, the battle begins in your mind, and you have to decide, gosh, I'm suffering. What's it worth me continuing? Is it really worth all this effort to come third or fourth? Whereas the athlete coming first never asks that question, because he's benefiting and he's going to win anyway. And so we now know that there's these mental processes get involved. And in fact, what becomes a predictor of your performance is your emotional response. And it's how you feel about the event and how important it is to you. By that, I mean, how do you feel about it? What's your emotion? Are you feeling great? And that's why the best runners and the best athletes are really enjoying what they're doing. And that's because you need that emotion to be successful. But then you also have to have this rational thinking that actually I'm prepared to put up with all this pain because it's worth it. And the end of the day, the physiology sets a limit, but how close you get to that limit is determined by your emotion that you express during the race, i.e. if you're positive about it, and secondly, how you battle with this to justify continuing even though it's hurting.
And that's because what I read is that you suggested that fatigue is an emotion. So if people if people can – and what you're saying to understand you is that you're saying if people can become comfortable with that fatigue, then if they are an endurance athlete, they'll see more success?
Yeah, correct. And we did find in these experiments that the winning athletes actually suffer less than the guys coming second and third, because they've got the positive affect. They interpret the exercise as being less demanding on them, and so they enjoy it more, and they continue to enjoy it right through to the finish. Whereas the people who come second and third, there's a point near the end of the race, two-thirds through the race, where they start questioning whether it's worthwhile continuing, and their mood changes. Or conversely, if they get passed by another athlete, the mood changes, and that's the end of it. Their physiology fails thereafter. So those are systems where the physiology isn't the limiting factor. It's the emotion of the event that determines the outcome.
Now, have you looked at anything correlating to like the flow states if you're winning, if you're one of the top three in your event and you're doing an endurance event, does that push you over into what's called the flow state, and how does that affect performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to be the winner, you have to be in the flow state, and that probably is the outcome, or the key determinant of the outcome. And we haven't yet really got a way to measure flow during laboratory experiments, but we're working on it. But I absolutely agree with you that the athlete in flow, it's just so easy, and you don't really, time just passes so quickly, and you don't have any of these doubts about your performance. What's really interesting is that flow, the easiest way to get into flow is to be involved in an activity that's going to kill you if you don't. So there's evidence that people who do activities that are really taxing and at which you risk your lives, they get into flow instantly, and they don't think like the rest of us. They're not thinking about these things. They're just going through the motions, and it's automatic pilot. If you can get yourself on automatic pilot, then your chances of winning are much, much greater.
And I mean, down in South Africa, obviously you have exposure to a bunch of extremes in terms of environment, and you know everybody from surfers to runners. And it's interesting because upcoming, I will be interviewing a professor, Dr. Csikszentmihalyi, I believe is his name. And so I wasn't planning on asking about flow states, but I think it's so – that's so interesting to see. As a runner, have you experienced flow yourself? And it, like, at what point do you think flow kicks in?
Yeah, you know, I first experienced flow when I was playing cricket. And cricket's a bit like, well, it's our equivalent of baseball, in which you are on bat for a long time. And I remember all my best performances, I don't remember what happened. And I didn't know how I got there. I can remember one game where I went in and I batted for an hour and scored a lot of runs and came out an hour later, and I didn't remember one thing. I don't remember one thing of what happened in that hour, except when I was out, I was dismissed. And the other times where I really batted well, it was exactly the same. Now, I only ever achieved that once in running, and that was when I ran my best marathon. And the last 10Ks, I can't remember a thing about it. I just it was just went by with in a flash, and I don't remember anything about it. So I was in flow. And Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, I met him at Stanford in about 2000, and I'm sure he won't remember it, but you can mention my name to him. And he's the expert on flow. He's the world authority on flow. And you would be well advised to ask him, how do people get into flow? That's the key, because as I've indicated, if it's life-threatening, if you're surfing a 60-foot wave, you are in flow. The minute you catch the wave, you get into flow. If you're coming down a mountain in skiing or snowboarding, you are in flow, because otherwise you die.
Well, to correlate the two, Tim, I mean, you wrote The Lore of Running, and he just published the flow state of running. I'm not getting the title right, but he just published a book on the flow of running, and you published The Lore of Running. And since kind of going down this, I've been getting back on my mountain bike, and you're absolutely right. You know, flying downhill and letting off the brakes a little bit is definitely it definitely achieves it. And you mentioned this, and I told you at the outset, I was a rugby player, and I played in the front row back in the days before. I was a hooker back in the days before. Now the referees, you kind of have to set and touch your opposing prop. And so I was a hooker back, 20 years ago, and we used to call our own scrums in from a meter out. And you talk about pushing yourself to the limits. I mean, I didn't realize, looking back on it now, I didn't realize how gnarly and dangerous that was.
And you can
relate to that. Now, the other thing I want to talk to you about is your book, Waterlogged. I read it a couple of years ago and helped develop a course on it for personal trainers. And what is the issue with hydration in sports? Do you think that the recreational athletes are overhydrating themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're exercising for less than an hour, you don't need fluids during exercise. So anyone, when I see these people running and they're carrying their water bottles and they're a little sturdy or overweight, I just think, just chuck the water away. And often it's not water, it's a glucose-containing drink. And there's actually more energy in the drink than there is in the that they're going to expend during the exercise. And so they don't understand that little problem. But you don't need to hydrate if you're exercising under an hour. It's absolutely unnecessary. The problem was that the industry decided in the 1990s that they wanted everyone to believe that if you sweated out one bead of sweat, you were going to die of dehydration. And they wanted to target the gym recreational market to make sure that they drank lots of their product. And they were very successful in getting this dehydration message out. So literally everyone thought that if you go and exercise for 5 minutes in the gym, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to die if you don't drink, or you're going to underperform. So you better start drinking immediately. And there's absolutely no science behind that. All it did was increase the sales of their product. And secondarily, when you applied that knowledge to people running 5 or 6 hour marathons, in which they were running very slowly and they were being told to drink as much as tolerable, well, they did do that, and they drank so much that some of them died as a result. And that was a tragedy, because it was iatrogenic in a sense that the industry caused the problem.
And do you think, I mean, and this gets back to our discussion that we started with, because you don't need, and what's the reaction? Well, the question I want to ask, let me back that up a second, is what's the reaction if I drink a glucose drink before exercise? Doesn't that actually limit my body's ability to burn fat?
Absolutely, because you'll spike your insulin, and then you have to burn the carbohydrate. You see, humans are not designed to ingest a lot of carbohydrate, particularly carbohydrate that is rapidly assimilated in the bloodstream. And your bloodstream has only got 5 grams of carbohydrate in it, but then you take a drink, a 10% solution, and you drink 500 ml, and that's going to give you 50 grams of carbohydrate. So that's going to be 50 grams at least, and that's got to try and get into the bloodstream, which only allows 5 grams. So you've got to get rid of that 50 grams as quickly as possible. And so you hypersecrete insulin to try and drive it out of the bloodstream. And it absolutely is a crisis for the body. So, but then the insulin prevents you from burning the fat, because you have to burn carbohydrates to try and get rid of those 50 grams. Whereas if you're fat adapted, you would immediately start burning fat, and you wouldn't need anything else, because the fat can sustain almost any exercise that you would like to do as a recreational athlete. There are some limitations. So if you're running an 800 meters or perhaps a mile, maybe you do need to burn a lot of carbohydrate, and maybe the fat won't get you through. But once you go beyond an hour or two, or if you're a recreational athlete, fat's all you need.
And I think that's so interesting, because you do see all this stuff pushed, and especially the past few years, you're seeing all these gels and, you know, gels and lollipops and all that. And is that just all overkill? Does that come back to marketing?
Absolutely, and I'm responsible, because myself and two other athletes in South Africa developed the first gel. We called it FRN for the three of us, Fordyce, Rose, and Noakes. And that was the first gel in the world. And we promoted it particularly for running ultramarathons. And now all three of us are insulin resistant, and we had to cut the carbs in order to get thin again. And so we are terribly embarrassed by what we caused on the rest of the world.
Well, I think, again, it comes back to initially what you said. I mean, the whole process of living is we learn, and we evolve with that. Now, one of the things, what's the book that you recently released? You said comes out this week?
Called Law of Nutrition.
The Law of
Challenging.
Go ahead.
Law of Nutrition, Challenging Conventional Dietary Beliefs. And it's a story of what's happened to me over the last 6 years since I converted to a high-fat diet, and the way I got excommunicated from my profession and from my university. And it was my fight back. And so we had to go to court for 25 days, over 2 years. And it's the story of that, but it's more about the science of nutrition and where we got it all wrong, and why the high carbohydrate diet has no science behind it, whereas there's plenty of science behind the high fat diet. And so it's a lovely story about one man being targeted by his profession and by his university, and being demonized and thrown to the wolves, so to speak. And yet we fought back, and because I had some unbelievable legal help, and lots of support from really important people, we managed to show that I was right and the other people were wrong.
And I think this kind of ties in because, I mean, how does that play in? How does the diet that you promote play in with the paleo diet? Because in the States here, we see a huge promotion of like the paleo diet and the ketogenic diet. And it's a lot of, I think it really is shaking the foundations of a lot of people believe about nutrition.
Oh, absolutely. And it is the way of the future. There's so much evidence that humans evolved by eating this diet, and we de-evolved when we started eating cereals and grains and then eating more carbohydrates. And the medical consequences have been catastrophic, as we discussed earlier. And we detail all of that in the book.
And so go ahead.
And the thing, there are two big things that are going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. Firstly, in a few months' time, company in San Francisco called Virta Health released their 1 year data on showing that you can reverse type 2 diabetes, or you can put it into remission on this diet. And that is catastrophic for the pharmaceutical industry, which tries to say that you treat diabetes with insulin. So this intervention shows that if you eat a high fat diet, you can get off insulin. Wow. So 97% of diabetic patients using insulin were off insulin within 1 year of being on this diet, where they're either off or reduced their insulin dramatically. And a large proportion of those people no longer needed any treatment. And that's key, because medicine tells us that diabetes is an irreversible disease, and that you're always going to happen. You're just going to need to inject more insulin and take more medication. And Virta Health in San Francisco have shown the opposite. That's the first thing that's going to happen. That's going to shake up medicine, because insulin resistance is a driver of so many diseases that if we can manage it with diet and not through pharmacological products, that's huge. And the second big one is, my prediction is that in 2020, the U.S. dietary guidelines are going to change. They're going to say, we got it all wrong. There never was any evidence that we should eat a low-fat diet. Guys, you can eat as much fat as you like, and that's going to reverse your diabetes, or it's going to control your diabetes and prevent you getting sick. So those are going to happen within the next 3 years, and that those are game changers.
Those will be significant, big changes. Now, as we wrap up here, Tim, you're still at your age. You said you're almost 70, correct?
Yeah.
And you're still running and exercising on a regular basis, correct?
Yeah, indeed. I'm doing more gym now. I've joined CrossFit, and I'm really enjoying it. It's miraculous what they found wrong with my body from all the running and the pain that we have to go through to try and sort out the muscle imbalances and the muscle tears and aches and so on. But I think in 2 or 3 years' time, I'm really going to be healthy because I'm combining my running. I continue to run, but I'm doing this muscle building work. And I think once you go into your late 60s, you want to die healthy, you better be doing your gym work as well.
I mean, so you think strength training plays a key role, you know, as you get it. And is it safe to strength train in the 60s and 70s, going into your 70s?
Absolutely. And it's not only that, it's essential. But you need good people to work with you. And fortunately, I've got good people showing me how to do it. And they're very careful of my 68-year-old weak body.
And see, I'm a big fan of CrossFit. You know, sometimes CrossFit gets a bad rap, but it's never the tool, Tim. In my opinion, it's never a tool. It's always the application. And if you found some good coaches who really take their time to understand your needs and modify the program, then I think it's going to be a marvelous fitness program for you.
Yeah, exactly. The people I use are really highly trained. And I think, you see, there is a movement against CrossFit because it promotes a low-carb diet. And many organizations in America believe that physical trainers should not be giving dietary advice. And so I know all about the story. It's the same people who targeted me are also targeting CrossFit for pretty much the same reasons. They want the dietary advice to come from the professionals who are controlled by industry to make sure that they never say sugar is bad for you. And that's unfortunately one of the keys, that if you have an organization that says sugar is bad for you, that organization is going to be targeted by those industries.
And it probably has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the sugar industry is one of the biggest money contributors to certain congressmen in American politics.
that would possibly be a factor.
Absolutely. No, there's no correlation at all. Well, Tim, I really appreciate your time. Now, can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing with the Noakes Foundation? Because I think the Noakes Foundation is what you set up to try to promote your dietary advice. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. So when we wrote The Real Meal Revolution, it became one of the best sellers in the history of South Africa. And I've always invested any money I make from writing into trusts. And so we formed, so that the law of running and so on, all that money went into a trust that funds a senior researcher at the University of Cape Town. When we got the money from The Real Meal Revolution, we said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to put this into a trust to promote studies of the diet. And in addition, we have an intervention program in the poorest communities in South Africa because we're trying to show that they are the least healthy because they eat the worst foods. And that actually you can eat this high-fat diet and on relatively little money. So many people in impoverished communities can afford to eat much better, but we have to provide the food for them. And the knowledge that you can't live on chips and Coca-Cola and ice cream and wheat and maize, which is what happens in South Africa, bread, maize, Coca-Cola, that's kind of the diet, and that's a killing diet. So we're promoting the idea that you can eat high-protein, high-fat diets at an affordable cost for many, many South Africans.
Well, and that's tremendous to see that you're taking your knowledge and you're taking the resources that you generate from your information and putting it out there to good use. I mean, I think a lot of people would be tempted just to put it in their pocket and go enjoy a good holiday, but I think it seems like you're giving back to the community.
Yeah, indeed, because I knew I'd be criticized. You see, you write books just to make money, which I've never done. I've always invested the money elsewhere. I am truly an altruist, and I never did science for my own benefit. I did it to try and help the communities.
All right, well, Tim, I really appreciate your time, and I know it's we're sitting here, we're talking across the world, but I've really when I've read articles, read your information, and read Waterlogged, I really appreciate the information that you share, and I wanted to expose your knowledge and your work to the listeners of All About Fitness. So I want to thank you for your time and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Pete. It's been a privilege to be with you on your program. Thanks so much, and thanks for what you do to promote these ideas.
That was a really fun conversation. Tim and I had never met before. Unlike a lot of the guests I have on this podcast, we just haven't crossed paths. As a speaker, as an educator, I certainly have the opportunity and the distinct pleasure to know a lot of experts in the fitness industry. But as I'm looking for guests and I'm trying to bring good content, I'm trying to reach outside of the circle of people I know and get experts in different areas. And I read some stuff by Tim. I read his book called Waterlogged. I'm going to have a link to his Amazon page down the show notes so you can follow up and read his information. But when I was doing a little research for this, what really fascinated me was that comment about how when he was in medical school, they didn't really talk about exercise, which is fascinating because it wasn't that long ago that he was in medical school. And so it really is, we've come a long way. Where now we're looking at how exercise can help promote health. Before it was seen as maybe a stressor that we didn't need to put on our body. So it was that to me was fascinating. So we've evolved. We've changed our thinking. Recently as 40 years ago, when Tim was in medical school, we were telling doctors that exercise may not be a good idea for the average person. Who are we to say that that a high fat, low carb diet is bad for you? We don't know. And the fact is everybody's gonna have a slightly different response to different type of inputs. I certainly, have empathy for Tim for having to go through the court case. All he did, if you do some research, all he did was he gave some advice to somebody about a low carb, high fat diet. And it really, he was taken to court for it, for saying it was inappropriate for him to make that suggestion. When in reality, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that he might be right. He was an endurance runner. He found that he was developing type 2 diabetes, onset diabetes, despite being extremely active. Now, one of the ironies about our conversation is I recorded it on the morning that I was actually in Anaheim about to go to Disneyland with my family. So my family, my kids and my wife were already at Disneyland. And it struck me that for the rest of that day, walking around the park, that he must be onto something, because when you look at the typical American diet, and obviously, a day in Disneyland is atypical, but what was really striking to me was walking around, and there were a number of people, and I'm not fat shaming. I am not trying to fat shame. There were a number of people walking around, or not even walking around, a number of people were scooting around these mobility scooters who were large, who were very overweight, you know, what I would imagine be overweight for their size, their height. But they had sodas. They had, you know, they're eating muffins. They're eating just really calorically dense, high carbohydrate, not even good carbohydrate. You know, they're eating calorically dense foods. They're drinking soda. I mean, they're eating a lot of sugar. You know, so maybe he's onto something. Maybe we ought to take a look at our diet. Maybe we ought to take a look at our recommendations. And it's true. You know, when you look at one of the most powerful lobbies on Capitol Hill, it's the sugar industry. It's the food manufacturers. You know, once upon a time, many moons ago, when I lived in D.C., I worked as a barback and a bartender in a restaurant. And we would do these big, you know, people would rent out the restaurant for these big events and everything. And one of the biggest events we had every year was the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Or I forget what the exact title is, but basically it was a packaged food industry. I don't think that was the name of it, but they spent a lot of money. Just to close out the restaurant was about 30 grand, 40 grand. And this is 20 years ago, 20-something years ago in the early 90s. But it was one of the biggest parties, and it was the packaged foods industry, basically, hosting a reception for all the politicians, you know, that they worked with and gave money to on Capitol Hill. So if you really look, when you look at the dietary recommendations we have, you know, how much are they influenced by various industries? By what, there's an author out there, not Eric Schlosser, the other guy, he calls it the industrial food complex or the industrial food industry, and that's true. So when you get somebody like Tim Noakes, who comes out and advocates, you know, against certain dietary, certain dietary guidelines, he may have a point. We may change our thinking. But as long as our nutrition recommendations are developed by an industry that makes a lot of money, are we getting accurate information? Are we getting the best information possible? Or are we simply selling out the guidelines to the highest bidder? I don't know. That's a whole nother concept. And you know, that's a point of a whole nother podcast. I need to find somebody to talk to about that. But the other thing is fatigue. That I find it interesting is fatigue. You know, we have this whole concept of no pain, no gain. And so one of the things I want to think about is, do we really need to exercise to the point of pain? You know, if it's just recreational exercise, no, we don't. We need to be active. We need to expend energy. We need to get the heart rate up. You know, we need to move. We need to get our muscles working. We need to work our muscles, our fascia, and our other tissues. But we don't need to go to that point of fatigue. However, there's a caveat. If you're a competitor, you know, you have to be able to understand to push. And I had this conversation with Juan Carlos Santana a number of episodes ago. Juan Carlos trains a lot of MMA fighters. And the difference between the fighters that win belts and the fighters that walk out of the rings dejected and having lost is that ability to go to the extra step, to work to fatigue. So if you're a competitive athlete, you might need to take another look at fatigue. You might need to find a sports psychologist who can help you understand how to go that place to push beyond fatigue. You know, because when you look at how special operators train the military, they train to be able to work through that fatigue. They train to be able to work at a high level of work output, work capacity, where they learn how to just ignore fatigue. Is that an emotional thing? Now, that kind of gets into the flow state. As I mentioned, you know, I interviewed Dr. Csikszentmihalyi, the author of The Flow State, who's done the research on it. The military, the special operators, the special forces training looks at the flow state because when you have people working to high level fatigue, it's putting them into a whole different category. You know, you're getting outside yourself. It's almost like a transcendental meditation, something Paul Cech and I talked about a number of episodes ago. So it's really interesting to have this conversation with somebody I never met before. And we're hitting a number of topics that are covered by other guests. And that's, to me, that's interesting. I love this stuff. I love learning different points of view. I love learning different perspectives. You know, since speaking with Tim about, you know, to record this podcast, I have been, you know, paying attention to the diet. I've been doing a little bit of intermittent fasting. I'm going to have somebody on soon to talk about that. But I've been also looking at my carb versus fat intake and trying to increase the healthy fats and reduce the carbohydrates just to see if I notice a difference. And frankly, you've heard me mention this before in the podcast, I don't care about weight, but I care about energy. I care about ability. I care about performance. Is it going to help me feel better? Am I not going to feel as fatigued? Generally, I don't feel fatigued unless my kids wake me up in the middle of the night. That's a whole nother, you know, whole nother conversation. Anyway, going a little bit long here. I just wanted to kind of wrap this up with a few different thoughts.
about fatigue, about training, and about a high-fat, low-carb diet. And finally, with hydration, you know, it's funny. I don't know if I mentioned this during the podcast. Maybe I did. I went mountain biking not too long ago when it was really, really hot here in San Diego, and I lost my water bottle. It fell out of my thing, and it lost most of the water. I finished an hour ride without having much water, and it affected me a little bit. It was hot, but in all honesty, all I had to do was rehydrate afterwards. So maybe he is onto something. And I have changed. I don't, hydrate with sports drink nearly as much since reading his book, Waterlogged. I just hydrate with water, and only when I'm pushing at a harder intensity than usual. Anyway, Dr. Tim Noakes, I think, is very valid, very research-based, very evidence-based, but he has promoted some ideas that some may find controversial. But the whole point of this podcast is to bring different people to you, different resources, different thoughts to get you thinking a little bit more about exercise and how you stay active. Anyway, if you enjoy this podcast, if you get a lot from listening to it, all I ask is you give me a good rating on however you listen to it, iTunes, Stitcher, whatever, because I want more people to get this information, have this access to this information. I'll have information about Dr. Noakes down in the show notes, including a link to his Amazon page and a link to his foundation. If you have any questions that you'd like me to answer on an upcoming Quick Fit Tip episode of All About Fitness, please email them to me at Pete@PeteMcCallFitness.com. My email is Pete@PeteMcCallFitness.com. My Instagram handle is PeteMcCall_fitness. That's Pete McCall, that line on the bottom, fitness for Instagram. And Twitter is PeteMC_fitness on Twitter. So I tend to tweet out the blogs I write, tend to tweet out other stuff I produce, other content. And what I'm trying to do is just get good information to you so you understand how to use exercise to improve your quality of life. Thanks for stopping by, and I look forward to having you stop by for future episodes of All About Fitness.